Hey, this is Old Gravy. Welcome back to the Old Gravy Podcast. We're going to have a good show today. Actually, today's show's called Growing Up Cop. And what I mean about that is if you grew up with a parent in law enforcement, you kind of hear and digest things as a kid that kind of formulate, you know, how you see the world. And I mean, it could be good and bad, but you definitely get some, what I would say, you learn street smarts at a very early age. And you also learn things that I don't think most parents say if your parent is in law enforcement. Like my father used to always say, the world's not on the level. And basically he was, what he was saying is things aren't always fair. They're not always good. And they're not always what you think they are. And that comes out of kind of, you know, being a police officer and, you know, being out on that type of job. That's how you're going to think. Another thing, you know, with growing up cop is they judge everything. And a lot of people are told not to judge, but cops judge everything because that's their job. They got to kind of figure out what's going on. Plus, they don't want to get hurt. They want to go home that night. But I get that judging thing. And we're going to get into that because I have a really good guest with us today. And I'm going to introduce him right now. I have Rich Zeoli from WPHT in Philadelphia. He's on from 3 to 7 every day, Monday through Friday. I mean,
most Fridays.
Most Fridays.
Most Fridays.
Unless you take off early, I guess.
Summer, it's debatable, but you know.
So what Rich and I have in common is we both grew up in North Jersey. Mm-hmm. Both our fathers were police officers. Mine was with the NYPD. Rich's dad was with the New York Port Authority. But before we get into growing up cop, because you grew up cop, I grew up cop, both out in North Jersey, both out in New York. But I want to tell the audience a little bit about who you are, too. And, you know, if you're in Philly, you know this guy, because he's the guy in Philly. But, I mean, you've been on everything. CNN, Good Morning America, Fox News. You're an entrepreneur. Yeah, you do corporate work, right? You'll get hired as a consultant for media. How to deal with the media if you're a corporate person?
Yeah.
Public speaking. You're a published author.
I am.
Anything else? Should I add? You consulted with governors and presidents and how to do debates. You've done it. You've done a lot.
But I'm a terrible handyman. You should know that. Don't ever ask me to do a thing around the house. Like literally, Tom, my wife hired a guy to hang pictures.
That's how bad it is.
And that was the most emasculating moment of my life when there's a guy in there, a professional, hanging a freaking picture.
Well, you're talking to a guy who thinks hanging pictures is difficult.
Yeah, so another thing you and I can relate to.
Absolutely, absolutely. Never mind our fathers were cops. We're also terrible handymen. Don't ask us to do anything. So so once again, I just want to say, if you want good conservative talk radio, you live stream. So if someone's listening to this podcast wherever, you live stream every day, they can hear you.
Well, yeah, we do. We have the Odyssey app. You can download it for free. Sign up, get the podcast, wherever you get your podcast. We podcast the full show 3 to 7 p.m. And yeah, it's a lot of fun. And 1210 WPHD, we're a 50,000 watt signal. So we cover a lot of most of South Jersey up until Trenton, that area, most of PA and up until probably closer to Harrisburg, Delaware, Maryland. So, and then at night, because a lot of stations have to power down, 37 states in Canada.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that's it.
And once in a while, we'll get an email from somebody listening in Nova Scotia who heard it, or Norway. Last week, I got an email from a guy in Norway who heard my show.
He picked it up in Norway.
Yeah, isn't that crazy?
That is amazing. I used to do that if I was driving out in the middle of Pennsylvania. I'd want to listen to New York radio.
Yeah.
Be like the old Bob Grant shows.
Oh, Bob was the best.
And I got to think that New York radio probably influenced you as a kid, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I would listen to Bob Grant and Howard Stern.
Yeah.
And Rush Limbaugh.
Yeah.
That's what I would listen to.
Yep. That's, I'm a decade older than you. I actually looked at your birth date. I go back to some of those old AM broadcasters in New York City because I'd be sitting in the backseat of my dad's car and he would have on New York radio.
Yeah.
And I really love talk radio. And obviously, I love your show. I kind of follow different people
Thank
in
you.
Talk radio. And for anyone out there, podcasts are great. But if you want what's going on that day in the world, you listen to a show like yours. And you're getting at the end of the day, absolutely, you're covering what's ever going on in the country or in the world at that moment. So That's why I think talk radio is wonderful. It's good stuff, and it's very educational too. And you get to hear how people feel and think, and that's what we're going to do on the podcast too today. But I want to get back to growing up cop.
Yeah.
So the Port Authority, the Port Authority Police. So if someone's not from the New York area, if you're in the New York area, you understand that the Port Authority Police, they secure every major transportation hub in New York City and in New Jersey. Matter of fact, I read their footprint is literally, get a load of that. I was shocked at this, from Cape May up to Canada. That is their footprint. I don't know all the ins and outs of that, but why don't you give us a little background about the Port Authority Police for listeners who understand NYPD, but Port Authority, why don't you give us some insight on that?
So the Port Authority Police Department is a bi-state agency. It's New Jersey and New York. And the governor of each state appoints either the chairman or the executive director, depending on the year. And they have a bunch of commissioners. The police, actually, I mean, on 9/11, there was the largest loss of police for a single department in American history.
56 yeah, officers.
And my father was at the time a retired lieutenant for the Port Authority Police Department, but he came back on the job. They literally reinstated him. And then he led a recovery team called Team Romeo for retired, R for retired. So Romeo, a bunch of retired Port Authority cops who got back and put their badges back on and got back in the pit and stayed there until the very, very end.
Wow.
Until the last body came out and they changed, you know, they shut down the efforts.
So for months
he was down there.
They were actually reinstated.
Yeah, they were literally reinstated. They needed the help, and it was amazing.
You lose 56 guys in a day. You're going to need some old hands come back in to kind of take control of things.
Yeah, and those guys are still suffering with a lot of PTSD and health issues. Remember back then, Christy Todd Whitman said the air was fine to breathe and it wasn't fine to breathe.
No.
Those guys have all kinds of issues, and they actually meet once a week, every Tuesday, all those cops get together. Cops all across that region, and they have lunch, and they just have a community where they hang out together and share stories. And I think it's very therapeutic for them.
Yeah, actually. No, I would think that. I mean, we know it. What a tragedy! And the Port Authority Police, you know, when people hear they're securing like the tunnels, the Holland Tunnel, the Lincoln Tunnel, the George Washington, the bus terminals, they're also dealing with everything that goes on outside, with rape, prostitution, stealing, fighting, the criminal element that's right outside the NYPD is dealing with, the Port Authority is dealing with it inside.
Yes.
So they go through that cop grind every day. If they're down on that beat, working through those bus terminals, through those airports, dealing with all the nonsense.
Yeah.
And that's some of the stuff that they kind of bring home with them. But I say bring home, like in the movies, they'll make the cop come home and he's always miserable and he's drinking and he wants to, you know, knock the kids around.
Right.
But my father was never like that.
I
didn't think so. And I would think both of us would say our experiences of growing up with fathers in the house kind of formed our personalities, like how we look, or I don't want to say our personalities, our worldview, how the world works. Mm-hmm. And like what I was saying about judging and stuff like that. And, you have a perspective that you take from your dad, which I actually think is good for business. And you're very entrepreneurial. I mean, what you do, you are an entrepreneur. You have your own radio show. You might work for a company, but then you have your other company. But I think a lot of those instincts that a father can give you who is a police officer can help you in life about everything. They give you, they deliver good instincts, because instincts is what makes you survive and thrive. So,
Street smarts. I mean, that's, to me, Tom, that was always the thing. My father would always reinforce, I'd rather you be street smart than book smart.
Yeah.
And that was a key thing. And trusting your gut instinct, to this day, I still do. And I think about that.
Oh yeah.
And being street smart about a situation, anticipating what could go wrong, is something I still do, to anticipate what could go wrong.
I'll tell you, I used to work in the bar business, but before I got into the bar business, my dad had this instinct, and I don't know if you inherit it genetically or you learn it, but I could walk into a place and I would know who was going to start trouble. Like where to be in the bar, where to stand, or when I was working the bars, who are we going to have to throw out of here in about an hour and a half?
Right, right.
Like you just pick up where most people go in, they put their head down, they start drinking and talking, they have no idea. That situational awareness. And I kind of felt like I got that from my dad, too.
And I'm guessing your father never sat with his back to the door ever.
Not often.
Yeah.
Not often.
Yeah.
I still kind of, I like to do that too. You know, not, I mean, I don't do it all the time, but I am conscious of who's behind me.
I am too. We walk into a place and it's a joke with my friends because they'll always leave the seat open that's behind the, with the back to the door. And every time I walk in, I go, no, you know, I'm not sitting there. Get out, switch. And they do it as a joke all the time.
That's my spot.
That's my spot. I need to see the door. I got to see who's coming in. If someone's coming to take a shot at me, I got to see it.
You want to see it coming.
Yeah.
You want to be ready.
And I don't want to be next to the bathroom like Tony Soprano was, because then, you know, it doesn't work out well for
him. Anything could happen.
Right.
And, you know, another thing my dad had about, you know, and my dad came from a different era in the sense he was an Irish orphan raised by his grandmother in Hell's Kitchen, went off to World War II at 17. So it's probably an earlier generation than your dad. But my dad was always warning, don't get jammed up by the system, meaning that the system can hurt you if you get too involved with it or you disobey it. And I've always taken that with me, too, in like little ways. Like I have guys who have businesses and they have three different sub-S corporations because they one's the marketing and this saves them on their taxes. And I'm always like that system thing. I'm like, that's I don't want to get involved in that. I'm just going to whatever the taxes are, my accountant's going to tell me I'm going to pay it. If you're doing a renovation at your house, you know, the plumber comes in, you don't need a permit. I could get this done. I'll knock down. And then I'm like, no, just get the permit. Like he always had a thing that, you know, the system, if you get caught up in it, it can create a headache for you.
Yeah.
Like, and I've always kind of, I try not to take those shortcuts. That doesn't mean I don't want to take those shortcuts.
Right.
But I always think like, what will the system do if I don't do it the right way? And here's another funny thing. We weren't allowed to sleep over other people's kids' houses when we were kids.
Never?
Did you have that rule?
No, they loved getting me out of the house. You
no, kidding? No, and it was so weird. As a kid, I'd be like, oh, they're all sleeping over Jimmy's house or whatever. My mother's like, oh, no. And I'd say to my mother like 10 times, why can't I sleep over there? And she goes, because if there's a fire, your dad can't rescue you. Which is all which isn't true. I would find out later as an adult, like just talking with family or whatever. But my dad must have run into some really creepy incidents with kids getting molested. And if he didn't know the neighbor, or even if he knew him, he didn't care. He must have come across stuff that he was like the sleepover thing was no good for him. Mm-hmm. Not that, and believe me, there were great people in our town or whatever. And I'm sure by my youngest brother, he probably got to sleep everywhere because by then you stop worrying as much. So these were, you know, this is all these things start getting embedded in you.
Yeah.
These, you know, small little things that he would kind of influence you with. And another scenario is my brothers and I would be sitting around breakfast eating Captain Crunch. And my dad would tell us, listen, if you ever get locked up, you don't say anything until I get there. And I'd be like confused, like what? You're a cop. You're telling me I shouldn't tell the cops what happened, even if I had nothing to do it. Then he'd say, what did I just tell you? You're the one I'm worried about. I said, you'd say, I'll talk to you once my dad gets here. And that's,
I got the exact same advice.
You know what?
100% the same advice.
Isn't that,
mm-hmm.
And that's great advice.
Tell them, call my dad. And when you say nothing until I get there, that was exactly what my dad told me.
That's the exact line my dad gave us. And he said it quite often too.
He said, be polite, be respectful, but don't tell them anything and say, I can't talk to you about this until my dad gets here.
Yeah. That was.
He also told me something too, and to this day, it stays with me. When I was learning how to drive, and that was a torturous experience because number one, we had a stick shift, so it was a Jetta with a stick, and my father, who has no patience, and I would be grinding the clutch, and but that was a whole. And he would tell me though, you get pulled over on the side of the road. Number one, if it's at night, turn on the interior light of the car.
Yep.
Keep your hands on the wheel.
Yeah.
Where the cop can see him.
Yeah.
And he said, and remember this, the Constitution is not with you on the side of the road. It doesn't exist in that moment. In that moment, you have to comply with what the officer is telling you.
Yep.
There's a time in court when you can deal with whatever comes down the road. But in that moment, you have to do what the officer is telling you. And it stuck with me because obviously I love the Constitution. I'm a constitutionalist, as you know. But I see so many people who get jammed up just by being jerks to the cop when they get pulled over on the side of the road. And what my dad reinforced for me was, you got to think about what's going through that officer's mind. He doesn't know as he's approaching that car if that person has a gun and is gonna shoot him. In his mind, he's prepared for the worst. So when he gets there and he sees the lights on, there's a respectful person with both hands on the steering wheel. Yes, officer. I'm sorry, officer. Thank you, officer. That's going to be a wonderful moment for both parties. You may still get a ticket, although I never did, knock on wood. But you may still get a ticket, but that's how you'll get out of that situation okay.
I've gotten out of a lot of tickets, and sometimes, and I don't know if it works anymore, but it worked for a very long time. If you did tell a police officer your father was a police officer, you increased your chance of getting a break. But you said a word, you said jammed up.
Yeah.
And that was a word, that's a cop word.
Yeah.
You don't want to get jammed up.
You don't want to get jammed up.
You don't want to get jammed up. And when you said it, I just smiled. I was like, well, no doubt about it. That's a, don't get jammed up. And my father used to say too, if you see the police lights, go the other way. Like, don't get like you see cop light, don't go, just go the other way. Don't get involved with the police.
Yeah.
Like, unless you can help them or something like that, but it's none of your business. Just keep moving along.
He would tell me when I was driving and there was traffic, he'd say, always leave space for you to be able to get your car out of there. Is that something? Did you get that lesson too?
I teach my kids that now. They're all
always
driving.
Always leave space so that if you have to, you can get out of that situation. Don't go right up against the bumper. Give yourself room.
My kids are so sick of that. Mm-hmm. And I always tell them, especially if you're in a tough neighborhood. Yeah. How do you know if you're in a tough neighborhood? I tell them you're going to see bars on the windows.
Yep.
You're going to see barbed wire around properties and big fences. You'll know it. You'll be able to see it. So that situational awareness, they were big on that because they know you could get hurt.
Yeah. Well, it's back to the street smarts, right? The situational awareness of thinking, anticipating what that person walking down the street, anticipating what could happen in that moment, in that situation, and it stays with you. And it's good because you're always proactively thinking. And I guess the trick is to make sure you don't become a person who walks around paranoid in life or afraid to take chances.
Yeah.
But I think in our case, I mean, both of us, we both have taken a ton of risks and chances in our professional lives.
Yeah.
I think it actually emboldens you to do that. Because you can anticipate what could go wrong and you can prepare yourself for it in a way that is psychologically comforting.
Yeah.
So yeah, I could lose everything. Yeah, I could, this radio thing I could pursue and I could spend years driving to Philly back and forth and never get a show and waste my time. If you can think about the worst case scenario, which was drilled into me in my head, then I can prepare myself for it.
Yeah, it's I don't want to say it gives you, by looking at those dangers, it kind of gives you a little bit of, I don't want to say invincibility, because but it does give you confidence that you can kind of measure what the worst case is, what the the best case is, and what might fall in the middle, because you're kind of aware of that. And another thing, I'm sure there could be some kids who are, adults who grew up with cops and they had a miserable existence.
Sure.
Because they might have just had a miserable dad or who was just overwhelmed with the job because it is a tough job. You go every day kind of dealing with that type of world. It gets really difficult. But we're going to take a break and we're going to be right back with Rich Cioli from WPHT. He's on 1210 every day from 3 to 7. You should tune in if you get the chance. We'll be right back. Hey, welcome back to the Old Gravy Podcast. I'm here with Rich Cioli. He's my guest today. Once again, I wanted for him to come out here and do this show with me. I would definitely want to plug his show on 1210 WPHT in Philadelphia every day from 3 to 7 p.m. And you know what? Check him out. He's always a guest on Fox News. He's always a pundit. You really get some. And Mark Levin, you do his show.
Yeah, I fill in for the great one, Mark Levin. Yeah. Whenever he asks me to, I try to do that. So.
Wow.
So that's always fun.
That's really cool.
And Jimmy Failla, who's got Fox Across America, or Fox News Saturday Night. His talk show is Fox Across America, but Fox News Saturday Night. So I'll be on with him this coming Saturday.
That's great.
So depending on when we air this, it'll be Saturday, whatever the date is. What date? What? You know, that's the problem when you're doing radio, right? You got to remember that people listen at different times. So if you are listening now after Saturday, March 23rd, go back and watch the episode of Me On with Jimmy Failla Saturday night. If you're listening before that, tune in this coming Saturday.
That's the problem with a podcast.
Right.
You know, so that's why we do these kind of general, like, growing up cop today. Me and if you're just, you know, if you sped up onto the podcast, we're talking about we both were born and raised by two police officers and how that affects us through life. And we're kind of kicking around some of these police stories today. You know, I got a good story from the Port Authority where your dad was a lieutenant. A friend of mine was in the Port Authority, and right after 9/11, and we talked about that terrible day and how many police officers from the Port Authority were lost. It's a crazy number, 56. But when George Bush flew in to give that speech, with the bullhorn down at the pile, it was a lot of things. It was awful. But as he comes in, they land him in the helicopter, probably over at Newark Airport, and they're going to drive him over to Ground Zero. And a buddy of mine, a big guy, he's about 6'3", 240 pounds, and he's, the way he told me the story is the guy next to him was a Port Authority cop. This guy was like 6'7" or something. Two big guys, and as they let them go up to the front of the line because there's a receiving line as the president's going to come off. A lot of dignitaries, the mayors, everyone's there. Everyone's, quite frankly, probably a little bit traumatized. And I would think those two Port Authority police officers, they were probably angry as hell. They were pissed off. Traumatized, but because traumatized is what will piss you off.
Yep.
And they're standing there. George Bush, they let those two guys be the first two guys to welcome him. When Bush comes down, the way he explained it to me, he could tell Bush was emotional. Like this is something he was dealing with. This is a world crisis. America's never really seen anything like this before. And as he walks by, he shakes their hands. But then immediately turns around to come back, and he grabs both of them like in a bear hug on their shoulders. And he's a lot smaller than them, I would think. Mm-hmm. And he looks at them, and he goes, "I'm glad we got guys like you." And he goes, "We're going to go get those fuckers." And
nice.
That is something that
he said the F word.
He said the F word.
Wow.
You know, people would be like, you know, I'm sure some nitwit out there will be like, "Oh, that's not presidential." These are men,
yeah.
And these George W. Bush, regardless if you like his policy, that guy
in that moment, hell yeah,
knew someone was going to pay a price, and he was talking to two guys that were going to go issue that beating in whatever way. Meaning, they were not technically they were going over there, but men like them they represented.
Yes.
We're gonna go do some real heavy duty ass kicking.
So you know what else I just thought of? Being the son of a cop prepares you for a life of eternal ball busting among your buddies.
Yes.
Because first of all, cops have the graveyard humor.
Yeah.
Right? The gallows humor. That's how they survive the job, and they bust balls. And that is one of the currencies of life today.
Yeah.
When guys get together and bust balls,
yeah,
it's fun. And
it's
you can handle it. You can survive it. You know, it's good. My dad was doing the World Trade Center when President Reagan landed the helicopter, Marine One, on top of the building, on top of the tower. My dad was there, and President walked by, threw him a couple packs of matches. And my dad gave them to me. I still have them.
Wow.
And it says the White House of Ronald Reagan signature, and it's got Marine One on them.
That's cool.
I still have those.
Yeah. That's cool. That's
you and I like cigars. Remind me not to use those matches when we light a cigar.
No,
together,
of course.
Okay?
Don't ruin them.
Don't ruin them. Yeah.
Don't ruin them. I keep some stuff. My dad's no longer with us. Lived a good long life to 87. But I have certain things that would be interesting for another show that he brought home from World War II. But I cherish them just probably the same way that, you know, your father gives you something and it means something. It lets you go back in history in a way.
Where did your dad serve in World War II?
You know what? He was 17. He left to go to boot camp in the Navy at 17.
Wow.
And his grandmother signed him in. He wanted to go. Everyone was doing it. And I guess getting out of Hell's Kitchen to go fight the war was probably kind of
a
great thing to do. It was like an opportunity. But basically, he was a naval amphibian unit or whatever, and he kind of marched across Europe, believe it or not, kind of following the army. And they never ran into any Germans. He said, it was funny, he would say, you know, they got lost a lot while they were making their way to Germany. But I will tell you what he got me. So once they get into Germany, they're in Dresden, and the place is a disaster. Like he described it. Now I've seen pictures of it, but as a kid, he would talk about it. But he jumped, they put him on a German destroyer, because that's where they're going to, I don't know, a bivouac or whatever they call it. That's where you're going to live. He gets on the ship, goes up on the ship, hoists down the Nazi flag, folds it up, puts it in his bag, and that's in my attic.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a great story.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah, that was...
That must have been one of a moment in his life he would never forget.
Yeah, but you know what? You know what the problem is? As like, you know, he's a high school dropout. But believe me, he was well educated. Not even from the street. He loved to read.
Yeah.
He had a really big intellect, which I admire so much now as an adult. How much you could learn. I'd be in college. He'd be correcting my spelling, and I'm not using the right word. But yeah, there's like some cool things. I'll give you another story about him real quick as a police officer. So when Malcolm X, okay, you'll get a kick out of this. I actually was reading about Malcolm X in probably in my mid 20s or something. I'm reading the book, and this has happened in other situations. And I'm like, Dad, you got to read this book. You were a police officer in Harlem. This is all happening around you. This is like the Black Muslim movement. Malcolm X is, you know, a big time leader, and he gets killed. He gets assassinated. And a lot of people believe, and some people on the show might know the history of the Black Muslims, but Elijah Muhammad, and they even think Louis Farrakhan. Have you ever heard this?
I have not.
That they believe Louis Farrakhan had something to do with killing Malcolm X. And
wouldn't surprise me.
And what was happening at the time is Malcolm X was kind of breaking away, it was like an inner office squabble with Elijah Muhammad. Now, this guy's the real deal. You don't mess with them. And that's so Malcolm X ended up being killed.
And do you remember Malcolm X? There's a famous speech of him going on about how the Democrat Party does nothing for Black people.
Oh, yeah.
And it's the plantation. It was shortly after that they whacked him. So
let me tell you, he's a very interesting guy. And the more I learn about him, the more I'm about to like get into like reading more about him. I did it back and I was fascinated back then. But the interesting part is my dad's connection to Malcolm X. And the connection is, at the funeral home where he's laid out for the funeral the next day, they send my dad and his partner over there in a squad car to guard the funeral home that night. So I'm reading the book and I tell my dad, Dad, this is interesting. You know some of the characters in here. Like, you should read this. But, you know, my dad's not going to read the Malcolm X book. He just doesn't have any interest. He'll read other books. But yeah. I guess when you live it, it's not a big deal to you. So he looks at me and he says, yeah, well, I guarded his body. They sent our patrol car, me and my partner, who I won't say his name, but they sent us over. And I'm like, oh, my God. I'm sitting there at like 25 years old thinking to myself, my dad's part of history. I'm reading this book
because
it's like a movie rolling in your head. It's like now, like my dad's like kind of part of all this, but it gets a little disappointing, and I'll tell you why. And I'm going to be truthful too. So don't use any of not. I don't have to worry about you, but anyone listening, don't use your historical bias about what I'm going to talk about. So I go, you sat out there that night? I go, well, why did they send you there? And he goes, I don't know, because he was assassinated. They thought they might steal the body. Or he said, blow. This actually is his words. He's probably eating his eggs at this time. Blow the funeral home up. So they couldn't make him a martyr. They couldn't have the big funeral the next day.
Right.
And I'm like, so you're there protecting. He's like, yeah. Like I could tell him, he's like, yeah. I go, what'd you do? He goes, we went to sleep. it gets worse. And I go, well, what happened if someone came in and stole the body or blew the building up? And I don't think he really meant it this way. He goes, we didn't give a shit. And I know that, but that's real.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just giving, and I'm not saying that they weren't going to stop anyone from doing it or whatever. But to him, it wasn't a big deal. Like, I'm reading this book and it's bigger than life. Mm-hmm. To him, you know, obviously, you know, the black Muslims in Harlem and the cops weren't best friends.
Right.
They weren't that invested in him.
Right.
If anything, they were probably on two opposite sides back then. That's the way the world works. Now, I could have toned that down and polished it up, but that was the realness of mm-hmm. it. That's what he gave me.
Mm-hmm.
And I find it fascinating. And this is another, just since I'm on this, and we're going to move off of Malcolm X, though I really find him fascinating. Muhammad Ali and Malcolm X were really close. And, you know, Muhammad Ali became a black Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he didn't go to Vietnam. Most
yes.
people think he didn't go to Vietnam because, you know, that famous quote, I got the Viet Cong didn't do anything to me. And he was kind of an anti-war movement. That's kind of what the written history is or the narrative. But what I've heard and what I've read is Ali didn't go to Vietnam because Elijah Muhammad didn't go to World War II. You don't fight for the government. You don't fight for the white man. And he went to jail. Elijah Muhammad backed up what he believed. So Ali would have gotten the Joe Louis deal. That means he would have gone, done exhibitions across the country. He would have held his belt. All the money would have came. For 3 years, he was suspended, lost tons of money. But the reason is, and there are witnesses to this, and he was very upset and he was very scared. He thought that if he didn't, his words were, if Elijah will kill Malcolm, he'll kill me.
Wow.
He might murder me.
Wow.
If I disobey as a black Muslim and I go to Vietnam, regardless if I'm running around there doing boxing expeditions, if I do that, he might kill me. Not a lot of people know that.
No kidding.
That's a great story, isn't it?
A phenomenal story.
Yeah. I wasn't there. I'm not a witness, but the sources that I've read and people that have talked about
makes sense.
It makes perfect sense. And he was close with Malcolm. They said mm-hmm. he was upset about it. Like, I could lose my life. And Malcolm was bigger than Muhammad. Muhammad's a fighter. He's a celebrity, but he's a fighter. But he's not Malcolm X. And if Elijah Muhammad would take out Malcolm X, taking out some fighter means nothing. Maybe to everyone now who, you know, they, like the celebrity of Ali, but it's a whole different level within that community. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was interesting.
It's fascinating. And I don't know how accurate the movie was with Denzel Washington, but it was great. And how the assassination, how they distracted the bodyguards. Because the bodyguards... This brings me to a topic, though, that I wanted to ask you. Growing up cop, Tom, the hardest part was actually watching movies with my father, cop movies or cop shows, because they would constantly tell me how unrealistic that was.
Yeah.
This is, he couldn't watch it. He said the most realistic cop shows were Barney Miller, because most of the time nothing happens, right? Because nothing happens most of the time. That's the thing.
Yeah, that's true.
It was like NYPD Blue. Every day there's something that, you know. Like, Barney Miller was the most accurate police show ever.
Yeah. Guys sitting around waiting, you know, it's a job.
Drinking coffee, shooting the ass, busting chops.
My dad loved that show.
Yeah.
That was a great show. Great cop show. Probably the most realistic, you're saying.
And because we would watch stuff and he couldn't handle Law and Order, any of those big shows, any of that's it's unrealistic. That's total bullshit. They'd never do that. That's not how it happened. And all right, Dad, leave. But if you go to the movies with him, it'd be the same thing. In the middle of the theater, be like, they wouldn't do it that way. But my dad actually wound up meeting up with Sonny Grasso, who is the guy Popeye Doyle, you know, the famous The French Connection.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And Sonny Grasso did the book and the movie about it. And my dad got to know him. And so my dad was able to help advise on a couple of projects.
Wow.
To help talk about how to make it more realistic.
That was the heroine, right?
Yeah, The French Connection.
I got to read with Carl, was it? No, was it? I'm thinking it.
Gene Hackman played Popeye
Doyle. Gene Hackman, that's right.
And who's the other guy?
I don't know. I got it. You know what's funny? That's on my list to rewatch that. I think I watched it when I was
Roy
young.
Roy Scheider, right? Is that?
He could be.
I think so.
From Jaws.
I could IMDb this right now.
Yeah.
You know, that's the beautiful thing about it. But Sonny Grasso was behind that. So my dad and Sonny became friends because my dad became an author after he retired. He started writing books. He actually wrote a book about the Port Authority bus terminal called 625 8th Avenue about all the craziness that happened at that place in the 70s and the 80s when it was just...
It was chaos.
Chaos. Runaways and hookers and
it
drugs.
It was Gotham.
It was Gotham. I mean, New York City at that time was Gotham. When your dad was a cop, when my dad was a cop, New York City was... For the Lower East Side, you didn't go to the Lower East Side.
No.
Now it's all hipster bars and brunch.
Yeah.
You didn't go to the Lower East Side. Hell's Kitchen was called Hell's Kitchen for a reason.
Yeah.
Now it's hipster. Yeah. It's restaurants and coffee shops.
They changed the name. They call it Clinton now.
Is that what they call
it? Yeah, they actually, and I don't know if people do. I'll know it. I always know when I'm on a certain street, I'm in Hell's Kitchen. But you know what? I know that, and this is how old I am. I used to get on the train in 1978, 1979 and go to work at Yankee Stadium. My dad allowed me to go take the bus into George Washington Bridge, get on the subway, and I'd be carrying an apron full of $20 worth of change. And my head was on a swivel, though. Believe me, I knew when I went to work. But I remember, like, other kids in the neighborhood, like, your dad let you go into the Bronx by yourself? And I'm like, yeah.
Yeah.
And I got to go to work.
That's good.
It was a great experience. It really was.
Letting your kids try things. But this was an area, actually, where it was kind of the opposite with us. My dad was a little overprotective, I think.
Right.
Even with my son, we went down to Clearwater a couple weeks ago for spring training. And my son is nine. Patrick's nine. And my dad and I had to use the bathroom because, you know, of course, our age, you got to use the bathroom all the time. Patrick didn't have to use it. So I said, all right, buddy, we'll just wait out here. My dad goes, no. He's got to stay and watch him. I said, Dad, he's fine. He's nine. We're in Clearwater. We're in the ballpark. Nothing's going to happen to him. So my dad went in the bathroom with me. But I've never seen a guy take a leak faster. And he skipped washing his hands and went right back out there with my son. The cop instinct never leaves you.
Yeah. You're always worried.
So...
That, like, you don't want anything to happen on your watch.
Yeah, well, that's what it is.
Yeah.
And get home safe.
Yeah.
That was always a thing, too.
No doubt about it. And I think, you know, the Port Authority, like, you went into those bus terminals, especially in the 70s, 80s. It's even getting worse again today, I'm sure.
Yeah, we're going backwards.
Yeah.
We're taking New York backwards. They cleaned it up, and now we're going back to the 70s.
You know, a lot of guys in my town became Port Authority cops. That's why I'm so familiar with it. And a funny story, my brother's a banker, my older brother. And he's on his way to J.P. Morgan's, got the suit on, he's walking through. And all of a sudden he looks up and he sees this guy, big guy, hair crazy. He's got tats down. He's got like tights on, gym shorts. He's like, it looks like a homeless guy who's big, physical, and out of his mind. And my brother's, you know, he's, you know, eyes straight ahead, New York, get to work. He looks out to the right. This guy is making eye contact with him. My brother's like, what's he looking at me for? And my brother's big. He's 6'2", you know, former NFL linebacker.
Yeah.
So he's not intimidated, but he still doesn't want this guy picking him out of all the people in this terminal. This guy starts now beelining for him. He sees him coming around, like, towards him. Like, he knows he's being stalked by this guy. Anyway, he's a good friend of ours, grew up in our town. He's undercover for the Port Authority. He's got a big wig on. He's got a fake tattoo thing on, and he's wearing this crazy outfit doing undercover work. I always thought that and he was, I'm sure your dad knows him, too. He's had a few heroic kind of events as a Port Authority cop.
Well, it's funny, the community, right? The camaraderie between them is pretty amazing.
Oh, yeah. I think it's...
Now, did your dad have a cop bar that he would go to? Was there one bar that all the guys would go to?
Well, this is interesting. See, my dad did something you're not supposed to do, you know, telling us not to get caught up in the system, but he broke that rule, and he moved us over to Jersey, where back then you had to live in New York City. Like, we nearly lived in Staten Island. We did live in Inwood, New York, in Upper Manhattan. Then he moved the family when we were very young, moved us over to New Jersey. And it was kind of like one of the reasons, like, my parents were always like, my parents never fought with our neighbors. If they put up a big fence, if someone had a barking dog, they didn't get involved because everyone was worried about someone dropping a dime.
Right, yeah.
You know, if someone didn't like you, they'd drop a dime on you. So, I kind of picked up on that too. Like, you know, don't fight with your neighbors. It's not worth it. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying like my dad taught us that or whatever. It's like, it's just easier to have a good relationship.
Choose your battles, as my dad used to always tell me.
Choose your
battles and don't make a federal case out of this.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
was another common thing in my house. Don't make this a federal case. And choose your battles.
Yeah, it was kind of like a secret we had. Like, even though everyone knew my dad was a cop, you know, even he was friends mm-hmm. with the cops in town. But, like, we knew that, like, there was a don't get in trouble because dad could get in trouble. But he had an apartment or something with my aunt or, I don't know, they shared at her house. She had something that she leased to him or whatever. Believe me, he was doing whatever
the
he had.
The residency, he had to cover it.
He was doing whatever he did. But I remember I was a kid. I used to have to go get, all my brothers would get this job. Say I'm 9 or 10, I got to go get milk, bread, in the New York Daily News at the time. I'm in the Bob's Delicatessen, and this guy comes up to me. And I don't know this guy. And you know everybody in the neighborhood. It's North Jersey. One house is, you know, on top of each other. You know all the kids. You know all the families. I don't recognize this guy. And he comes up to me. I'm like 9 or 10 years old. And he goes, hey, you live in the White House with the green shirt? Yeah, I live there. And he's like, your dad's a New York cop, right? And this guy's like a big guy. And he's got like a presence to him. And I'm like, yeah. I go, no, I live in that house. He goes, your dad's a cop. I go, oh, no, my dad's not a cop. And he goes, no, you're in the White House with the green. Your dad's a New York police officer, isn't he? I'm like, no, he's not. And then I pay and I'm like, see ya. And I walk out the door and I go home and I tell my dad. Like, even then I knew to keep my mouth shut.
Right.
Make a long story short, the guy does live two blocks down. He's a New York cop. He's a New York cop who's also kind of doing the same thing. But I actually, he made me nervous. It wasn't like some other guy in town asking me if my father was a cop who I might have recognized, but he looked so authoritative
mm-hmm.
that I was like, wow, they're on to us.
You were worried.
On to us. And I couldn't get home fast enough to download it to my dad. He's like, don't worry about it. We'll figure it out.
But whatever. You did your job. You went to tell your dad.
I did my job.
You told your partner.
Yeah.
You covered his six, right?
And I kept it straight and got home and didn't say anything.
That's it.
Yeah. And that's also another lesson in life. You know, don't ever blow a mistake not to talk. You know, there's like an opportunity.
It's a great point.
Yeah, not to speak.
Well, my dad would always make the point of saying that, and I think when you grow up the son of a cop or a daughter of a cop, this is acutely drained into you. It could be the last time you ever see your dad or your mom when they go out for their shift. It could be their last shift. So you always have to keep that in mind. And that's something that I thought of growing up in that sense. I mean, there were days where my dad was doing undercover stuff and we wouldn't hear from him for days. And no news is good news.
Yeah.
We would have that motto. I'm sure you probably had that too. No news is good news.
Yeah, no, yeah.
And realize that today could be the last day, the last shift. So with thinking of that in mind, I try to use that in my life today. Don't go to bed angry. Know that when you leave the house, don't take the day for granted. You don't know what's going to happen. In their profession, they literally don't know what's going to happen.
Yep.
But in our life, we don't know that either. And we should always be mindful of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And that, you know, you bring up a point. And I know my sister was like that. My sister, who was the oldest in the family, like she had that concern every day my dad went to work. She had more of a, you know, she obviously she was older than us. Mm-hmm. But she was always aware that he was going off to work. And I think that made her nervous. Oh, she would tell you it made her nervous. Yeah. That's and, you know, that's part of the job.
And that's what they call it. The job. He's on the job.
Yeah.
He's on the job.
And locked up.
Mm-hmm.
Like a lot of, like most people say, did you get arrested or whatever?
Locked up.
Yeah. You better watch yourself. Like I'd even say to my friends, knock it off. You're going to get locked up.
Yeah.
Yeah, locked up. You start picking up
the cop colloquialisms, right?
The language. And I, you know, I think today, wow. It's tough being a cop today.
It is.
Oh, I wouldn't mind. We should, that could be a show into itself, you know, being a cop. And I've talked to cops and, you know, that, and, you know, I said, we can't help ourselves. So we're going to talk politics a little bit.
Sure.
But that Ferguson effect has, from the Michael Brown case, I don't know how many years it is, mm-hmm. but it just didn't start with defund the police.
No.
That Ferguson effect with Michael Brown, that with the media twisting that whole story and the and the politicians of the left blatantly lying to you that that kid put his hands up, that and it was a total lie. He reached into the car, tried to get the weapon, then ran away. The cop got out, told him to freeze. Then he charged him. And then that hands up thing.
And there were people in the media doing that. Hands up. Oh. That was a thing. It became a thing. Hands up.
Yeah, I remember, weren't they all on The View with their hands up or Good Morning America? Mm-hmm. And it was all a scam.
So cops today, particularly in cities, they're not looked at by the politicians as the good guys. They're looked at as the bad guys. And you have a lot of these prosecutors in Philadelphia. I mean, Larry Krasner is one of them. The cops are the bad guy. They perpetuate the system, the racist system that is American capitalism, everything else. These prosecutors around the country, Alvin Bragg and others, I mean, so you're a cop and it's already a dangerous job. You already have people that don't respect what you do. Now you're dealing with the fact that you've got the guy you arrested is back on the streets. If something goes wrong, you are going to be presumed guilty. It's going to be presumed that it's on you.
Absolutely.
You got to fire your service revolver, or you got to beat a guy. You got to do something, whatever. Be prepared to know that you're going to be the one that has to explain it. It's going to be looked at as you did something wrong.
Yeah.
And they'll try to find a way that you did something wrong to prove that point. It's a very tough job being a cop in a city today.
And we were talking about the system that my father would always say, don't get involved. This system today, and it's been this way for decades. If you're a cop and if you don't make a mistake or a slight mistake or a big, whatever it is, that system is going to chew you up and spit you out. Your whole family, too. That system will come to destroy you. It's such a dangerous way to run a country.
Well, and more people now are getting out when they hit their 25.
Yeah.
There used to be a thing where I think cops would stay on a lot longer, and they would stay on the job for 30, 40 years. Nowadays, everybody 25, they're out, they're done, they get their pension. As soon as they can max that pension, whatever it is, 25, 30 years, depending on the department, they're out.
Yeah.
And then they go do private security, because the longer they stay, the longer they risk.
You increase your odds.
And so they don't want to deal with it.
And I also think, unfortunately, and I'm sure there's, hey, listen, this is what I believe. So I think a lot of cops, a cop's job is to prevent the crime. It's like when they had stop and frisk or whatever. A cop's watching what everyone's doing, and everyone in the neighborhood knows who the cop is, but they're usually watching who the troublemakers are.
Sure.
It's not like they know who they are. They work this area. But instead of busting this guy's chops, keeping an eye on him, locking him up, finding out if he has a warrant, a lot of that kind of proactive police work is better left alone, because like you just said, the more interactions you have, you increase your chances of getting jammed up or getting killed. And I can only imagine how slow you are to kind of actually use force today.
You think twice about it.
And
so now you've got a situation where you have to wonder how many cops are thinking, I don't want to get involved in that. A, they're not going to prosecute the guy anyway.
Yeah.
And B, I have a risk now that I'll be the criminal.
Yeah.
That's a terrible mindset. It's bad for everything.
I watch some of the local video now. I've never seen cops wrestling with people as much as I see now. Back in the day, you started wrestling with a cop.
You got a baton.
You're going to get
club.
The billy. Yeah.
My dad had a billy club that had a smiley face on it.
Yeah.
And that's what you'd get.
You'd get the nights that's coming out.
They won't do that anymore.
And now they're like, you need 100 cops to control 10 people, where you used to need 2 cops to control 100 people, because they saw the first 2, boom, they're smacked over the head. And I don't, obviously, we don't want a society where cops just get out of the car and start beating the crap.
Of course
we're talking about people that actually deserve a beating for society.
I always say a police officer is the only profession where if somebody does something wrong, it's a reflection on every single member of that profession. So if a cop does something wrong, like it chases a guy and shoots him in the back, like that one guy did in South Carolina, whatever.
Yeah.
Every cop in America has to answer for it.
Yeah.
It's BS. They don't do that. You know, if some dentist does something to a woman in the chair, not every dentist has to answer for that. We don't defund the dentist.
Yeah, you got to reform the whole dentist industry.
Industry, right?
Yeah,
they all got to
go back to training.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. They don't do that, but only with cops.
It is a tough, let me tell you, it's a tougher job. It really is. Like, and then they want more training. Like, we're going to turn them into Navy SEALs with PhDs in psychology and sociology.
Yeah, they want them to be social workers, too.
Yeah.
And they want to de-escalation, which look, sounds great. De-escalation sounds great at the moment in the time. But the problem with anything like de-escalation or any of that, which is a noble goal, but sometimes the criminal does not want to de-escalate that situation.
No.
He's not interested in that.
No.
He's interested in getting away from you.
Yep. It's they have a tough job, but obviously when doing this show, these influences are big. If, like I said, growing up cop, it kind of makes you look at the world in a different way. It has a lot of pluses. So I want to thank Rich Zeoli for being my guest here and talking about our dad's jobs and how it influenced us, the way we look at the world and, you know, how we make our way through it. So thanks for joining the old Gravy podcast, and we'll see you again. Thank you.